Nicholson, Reel 31. Still keeping to the Falklands, Michael, were you ever misinformed by the Navy and used in that way? You know, were you sort of imparting misinformation at any time?
Yes, yes, we were. I mean, how much we were, I'll never know, because, you know, if you're told lies, you quite often never find out whether they were lies or not. So I don't know how much misinformation we were given. I think, I mean, you know, the whole problem of censorship was, you know, our war against the military. I think the most prominent piece of misinformation that I can remember was the bombing of the airfield by the Vulcan bomber. Now, I can see why they did it. They sent this Vulcan bomber all the way from Britain via Ascension. It refueled, I don't know how many times, mid-air refueling. Quite an operation. I mean, for an aircraft that size, refueling mid-air must have been quite astonishing. But it was a propaganda exercise that we could send an aircraft from Britain and bomb the Argentinian garrisons on the airfield in Port Stanley. 10,000-mile flight. Now, being on Hermes, of course, we knew the bomber was coming. We were told it was. We knew what time it was bombing, and I actually heard after the operation the bomber returning over the task force over Hermes. Didn't see it, of course, too high, but we heard him over the radio saying that the operation was complete. I forget what the code was now, but he gave a code which said, you know, I bombed and it's successful. Well, we were then shown fairly soon afterwards photographs of the airfield. Now, these were aerial photographs taken by an AWACS plane, I suppose, and, you know, taken from, I don't know, 10,000 feet. And we were told by the Navy, look, see, it's been a total success. The airstrip's been completely destroyed. And so I went out that night, as Brian Hanrahan of the BBC did too, recounting the operation, what a wonderful success it had been, and that the airfield had now been destroyed. But of course it hadn't. We later learnt that all the bombs missed. One bomb actually hit the side of the runway, but it did no real damage, and that the Argentinians continued to use it as before. But we were used as propaganda. The Navy knew, the Royal Air Force knew, that it had been a failure in the hit. I mean, a great success in propaganda terms. But I don't know who they were trying to convince. I think it was simply for the home market. The Argentinians knew well enough that there's no damage was done. But as far as the British public was concerned, Maggie Thatcher and the military thought they needed a lift, needed something, you know, to boost morale, and the Vulcan bomber did it, and we were part and parcel of that misinformation.
How did you feel about that?
Well, I mean, we felt pretty uptight about it. Of course, afterwards, when we complain, they say, well, you know, it's terribly hard, blah, 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 blah. But they knew they were telling us lies. But you see, so many wars I've been in, and perhaps the Gulf was the most prominent, but in every war you are used by the military to pervert the course of truth in order to aid the war effort. And they will use you in any way they can to spread mischief, propaganda, black propaganda, to confuse the enemy, to boost morale at home. How do I feel about it? Well, you know, I would do anything. If the Germans were across the channel in Dunkirk about to invade my country home in Haslemere, there is nothing I wouldn't do to prevent them. I would happily negotiate and cooperate with the military to spread lies and confusion. But of course, 10,000 miles away, you don't feel the same urgency. I think they were wrong to use us that way. And it means, you see, the knock-on is that you'll never trust what you're told by the military again. We shouldn't then. As I've said earlier, we were very naive going to our first British war, and we tended to believe what other Brits told us. But other Brits can lie as easily and as frequently as other Israelis or other Americans or other Iraqis, you know. We felt very uptight about it. But there you are. That is the machinery of war.
Were you ever sort of trusted with information, you know, during the briefings you had on board, which you had referred to, you know, the plans, what was going to happen?
Well,
were you given that sort of information?
We were given, a fair bit of information. The biggest secret of the war was the UXB, the unexploded bomb. It was essential that the Argentinians were not told that their bombs weren't going off. And I think I've explained to you how the bomb worked. The Argentinian pilots just throw in these bombs at the ship. They hit the ships most of the time, but they didn't explode because they weren't fused. And so the detonator didn't explode the bomb. Now, had we told the Argentinians this, they'd have looked at their machinery, looked at the detonator mechanism, or the way they were being delivered by the aircraft, from the aircraft, and they would have realized what they were doing wrong. So we kept that a secret. But you must bear in mind that everything we were told was subject to censorship. Not a single censor, but a four filter censor. That is, you went to the... It was first given to the captain to look at. It was then given to his second-in-command to look at. It was then given to our minder, the MOD minder, a civilian mostly, or it was Rupert Nicol, the Navy minder. Then we were allowed to transmit under the eyes of the minder or Lieutenant Commander Nicol, and it was sent to the MOD. The MOD in London then censored it before it was passed on or allowed ITN and BBC to broadcast it. So, you know, had they told us that anything secret, that item would have been deleted somewhere along the line. It was as total a system of censorship as you could ever get, and one that was unique to the British military at the time. And I've never encountered anything quite as severe since, or before or since.
How important was it to have someone like Lieutenant Commander Nicol? You know, I understand from what you said earlier, he gave you as much support as he could in his position.
He did. You come across this occasionally. Do remember that Nicol wasn't a permanent member of the Navy. He was a reservist, and therefore, you know, was part civilian and part Navy. All the others we dealt with were fully, completely Navy. So they hadn't been quite as well indoctrinated. Rupert wasn't as well indoctrinated as the rest. And he tried to play it as fair as he could without jeopardizing the military operation. He was, in a way, our deep throat. He told us things and allowed us to do things which a non-reservist, I don't think, would have allowed. Our big fight, of course, was always with the MOD minders, who were a total waste of time. I mean, third raters, terribly, I shan't say cowardly, but scared out of their minds most of the time, and were sycophantic, totally counterproductive, created hostility where hostility ought not to have existed. And Rupert Nicol certainly made life a great deal easier for us because of his discreet, polite wisdom.
Did you have much to do with the Harrier pilots on board?
Yes, we met them. You see, the press are given officer status in all armies. And so that means you share the facilities of officers. Now, that is a two-pronged way of dealing with this. One, you feel complimented that you can be treated as an officer, and you go to the wardroom or the mess, and you eat and you drink, and you have the social atmosphere of the officer. But, of course, if you think about it, it can only be that way, because you can't have journalists mixing with the other ranks, because other ranks are not so tight-lipped, not so discreet, not so secretive. And so one of the ways of keeping you under control, of course, is to make sure that you are around officers most of the time. So So that people forget that. That's the reason for it. Not because they want us around, because they can't dare to have us strolling around lower decks asking asking indiscreet questions and getting indiscreet answers.
Did you pick up any disaffection from them? You know, you've explained so clearly the importance of the Harrier and its characteristics, and they were on the Invincible as well, I believe.
Yeah, yeah.
Was there any moans about the way they were being used? Did you
no.
pick up?
I mean, I've told you the story of the fog and the Met, haven't I? The Met office and why we couldn't broadcast that. The moan always is that we had gone down so ill prepared, but that is the way it had to be. If we had delayed long enough to be fully supplied and serviced, having gone down with all the right things on board in the right order, we may never have got down there in time to kick the Argies out. So anyone who moaned has to realise that it was a panic operation, and suffered in consequence. People say the Harrier won the war, and it probably did. Had it not been so effective, I think the Argentinian Air Force would have wiped us out.
Yes, you've explained how, what good pilots they were. What was your opinion of the ground troops? You have explained about the mess, in Stanley, and seeing the huddles of prisoners. But did you gain any impression of how they had fought?
I think I've already told you that the majority of the Argentinian soldiers were conscripts. Another thing people forget is that here we had a small British army invading an island well defended by a very large Argentinian army. At most we had 5,000 people, and they had, I forget the exact figure, but it was certainly four times, five times that, easily. Must have been maybe 10 times. My point is that although the numbers seem to have been against us, our army was the most professional army in the world, and still is. It's untouchable. Regulars, dedicated, hard men, well trained, using good equipment and under good generalship. The Argentinians was mostly conscripts, and they were mostly kids. I mean, so many of them looked like Indians, mostly terrified. They were well equipped because their invasion had been well prepared. They did have warm clothes on. They did have boots that came halfway up their legs so that they didn't leak. They did have proper sleeping bags. They were warm in their trenches, and they were well supplied with arms and ammunition. Ours, of course, it was the reverse. Because we left in such a hurry, the Paris, for example, before the Falklands war started, were about to leave for Belize. Therefore, their regiment had sent all their gear out to Belize. And when they left for the Falklands, they had nothing. They had the tropical gear on. The Marines were the same. Had these light tunics that they wear in the summer, when all their main winter gear was, I think, still in Norway because they've been on exercise there. And it is no secret that, one, when British soldiers advanced over Argentinian lines, they took clothes and boots off dead Argentinians. They took their sleeping bags. In many cases, they took their weapons too. There was a big discrepancy. But do remember that we had a fine army fighting a very young, scared, badly managed, badly commanded Argentinian conscript army. And as we saw at Goose Green, after that initial battle, Once the Paras went for it, the Argentinians collapsed. I think I told you that the night before Goose Green, Paras attack on Goose Green, all the senior commanders and the special forces who would have put up a much tougher fight were airlifted back to Stanley.
Did you gain an impression how the prisoners were treated?
They were treated well. Of course, they were. I think the only the only occasion I remember when it was fun to see them badly treated, because you don't have great sympathy for people who've been trying to kill you for a while, is that we airlifted a couple of hundred of them from the west of the East Falklands in these Chinook helicopters. And they were in a bad way, these guys. I mean, like most defeated armies. But they were all huddled into this helicopter and then flown extremely fast and extremely low by the British helicopter pilots, who wanted to give them a scare. I mean, they scared us too, but I can see the British helicopter pilots thinking, well, you know, we'll give these guys a bit of a shake-up this morning, and they went all over the place, and by the time it was over, these guys were vomiting and feeling extremely sick. Now, that was the only time I saw any so-called mistreatment of prisoners. The Brits have a great sense of fairness, and it certainly was extended to the prisoners then.
There were rumours here, you know, later on, about Argentinians being shot on the battlefields. Was that, you know, when after they had surrendered? Did you hear any rumours of that?
No, I never heard that. If it was true, it could only be in one or two instances. I never heard that. Certainly never heard that. But you know, you do have to remind yourself that men are ordered to kill, and then, you know, on a Monday, they're ordered to kill. By Friday, the war's over, and they're told to stop killing. And sometimes it can be very hard just to pull the curtain down. And if somebody's been firing at you and you've been almost killed yourself by that, and the war suddenly stops, you may decide you're going to finish this guy off. It's caused you too much trouble. I can see that happening in one or two instances. Remember, some of these British soldiers are pretty hard fellows. If they weren't in uniform, they'd be in prison. But to answer your question, no, I haven't heard that from anybody. No, not at all.
What were the conditions of the local people when, for instance, you went into Stanley? You know, did you get an idea of how they had sort of endured?
They'd had a very bad time. They'd had a very bad time because they'd been forced to move houses, because the Argentinians want a billet in the houses. If any of them were close to any sensitive piece of Argentinian equipment, they were moved out. And of course, they were. There was a great deal of danger for them, because we were shelling parts of Stanley. We were shelling Argentinian emplacements within Stanley. And as you know, three islanders died because we were trying to take out a very dangerous Argentinian gun that had been giving us a lot of problems, and so that had to be destroyed, and people died. And they had a bad time, but then it is as you would expect. You know, they were in the centre of a garrison that was slowly coming under attack. But they're very hardy people, very hardy people. They hated the Argentinians, of course. I mean, there were one or two instances where the Argentinians behaved as if they were the Germans.
Was there any resistance, do you know?
No, there was no active resistance. People cooperated wherever they could, of course. I mean, the radio station was closed down, if you remember. They weren't allowed to transmit. I remember one school teacher, to try and help the old people, used to have a little gathering every week or twice a week to bring the old people together, you know, kind of coffee mornings in Port Stanley, just to keep their morale up. And the Argentinians disbanded it because they thought it was a secret meeting, you know, all these 70-year-olds as resistance fighters.
What changes did you see returning 20 years later for your television series?
Oh, it was a new world. It was a new island. It was barely recognisable. You know, when I left it in 82, it was a derelict island. You know, I never wanted to go there again. It was all I remember it as being, because of the war, dirty, drab, cold, wet. And I'd only got bad memories of a rather awful month or so there. But when I went back, you know, I saw it on a fine spring morning. The air is enormously clear there. The water is clean as bathwater, clean bathwater. And of course, they've had an enormous injection of cash. They, when I was there, and I think I went back once again when Mount Pleasant Air opened, the world's fishing fleets were there, you know, devouring the sea, scooping up everything they could. All the East Europeans, the Russians especially, the Koreans were there, the Spanish, of course, who were everywhere, were just emptying the sea. And then, thank heavens, they got permission to issue licenses, and the these rogue fishermen are now paying handsomely for the privilege of emptying the sea of fish and squid. They're making a fortune out of squid fishing now. I think their income is upwards of £28 million a year from licensing. You know, £28 million spread among just over 2,000 people is a lot of money. There are new roads there. When I was there, there could only have been about, I don't know, 10 miles of tarmac road. And now there's well over 100 miles of tarmac road, 400 miles of road, that is new roads, not tarmac, but, you know, passable. There's a little hotels opening up. The housing development is quite extraordinary. I mean, nice houses built from kits brought in from Norway, mostly built of wood. The government issues land free, a plot of land free to inhabitants, and that land has a water pipe, electricity and telephone. That's all free, and all you pay for is the house on that plot. The hotels are full. They have gift shops there now, an internet cafe, quite a large restaurant. They have a couple of nice pubs opened up. They have cruise liners coming in, Americans, a lot of Americans visit the island. So they've got a new hospital, brand new hospital, fabulous hospital, and a new school, a new technical college. Believe me, I mean, it's a new island, and the people are full of optimism, and there is slow emigration there. Before, they were losing people, especially young people, people who leave and go to university and not come back. That trend's been reversed. We've met young people who'd left or were at university abroad, mostly in this country, Britain, but were determined to return to the Falklands. So it's I think I said, I went to the cemetery there, I went to many cemeteries there, but in Port Stanley, they've planted trees. There aren't many trees in the Falklands, it's too windspread. But for every Englishman, every Brit who died, they've planted a tree in this little cemetery. The bodies aren't there, but each tree has a name under it, dedicated to the person who died. And I said at the time, if these guys could see what had now happened 20 years on to the Falklands and the islanders, they'd know that their sacrifice wasn't in vain.
How much is the British taxpayer paying for this?
Well, again, it's one of the myths and legends that are being put about by the Foreign Office. You know, the Foreign Office always wanted to get rid of the Falkland Islanders. Rex Hunt told me, he was the governor, that when he went out there, he thought he was going out there as governor to look after them. But in fact, he realised, and was told in no uncertain fashion by the government, by the Foreign Office, that his job was to dismantle British possession of it. To get rid of it, to allow the Argentinians to come and take it. And that's, of course, what they still live in fear of, that the present British government and the ongoing Foreign Office still wants to dismantle it and hand it back to the Argentinians. They want to get rid of all our foreign possessions, as they're doing with Gibraltar. So what was the question again?
What is it costing us?
Oh, what's costing us? So one of the myths being put about by the Foreign Office and the lackeys of the Foreign Office is that, you know, and I think Max Hastings made this point in his and he ought to have known better, that it was costing Britain an enormous sum of money to subsidise the Falkland Islanders. I think he mentioned it was costing us £1,600 for every man, woman and child to maintain the Falkland Islanders, which is total rubbish. It's absolute rubbish. They are self-sufficient from the money they get, that enormous sum of money, 26 million, but over just under 2,500 people. They are totally self-sufficient. The only cost to the British taxpayer is maintaining Mount Pleasant Airport. Now, you may say, well, that's bad enough, because it is a large airport. And we have, you know, I think 800 troops there maintaining it. But think of this, once that airfield is built, that is money gone. That's finished. We've stopped paying for it now. It's been built, finished, end of story. The troops who are there will be paid wherever they are. You know, whether they're sitting in the Falklands or whether they're sitting on their backsides in Aldershot, they still get the same money. And add to that the fact that British troops use the Falkland Islands as a training base, free, whereas they'd have to pay to train in Norway or America or Cyprus. They'd have to pay for that. But in fact, they get that facility free in the Falklands. So, to answer your question, it's costing us virtually nothing to maintain the Falkland Islanders. And when you think what it cost us in human terms to keep them, what little cost in pounds, shillings and pence it costs us now, it's got to be marginal. I mean, if we were to start being finickety about a little bit of money that it's costing us to keep the Falklands, think what it's cost British families in losing their sons and fathers to get them back.
So after this war, had you had enough, you know, bearing in mind dangers you have faced again?
Yeah, I think after the Falklands, because it was an emotional war for us, because, you know, as I said, we were fighting alongside our own people. So it gave us a new dimension, a far more subjective dimension than fighting alongside an Israeli soldier or American soldiers or whatever. And seeing Brits die and seeing Brits buried, it is bound to have an effect upon your psyche. It's bound to, isn't it? So I think when I came back from the Falklands and I'd come back on a high, we'd had, you know, it was a high-profile thing, and I'd become a little famous because of it, I decided that maybe that was the end of it. And what kind of propelled me out of it, out of being a war correspondent, was me becoming a newscaster. When I came back, David Nicholas, who was my editor, was reshuffling newscasters from one programme to another. And the early evening news post became vacant, and because I had a fairly high profile, then decided I should do it, which was the biggest mistake of my life. I loathe being a newscaster. John Simpson tried it, and he had the same reaction. You know, we are not newscasters. You have to be a special kind of clone to be a newscaster, and I'm not a special type of clone. Thankfully, I got out of that after about 3 years. And went to, I think my very first foreign assignment at that time was Croatia. But then very quickly, a new war started. It was called the Gulf War.